Live and local on AM 770 KTTH. Your independent conservative host, Todd Herman, welcomes you to The Todd Herman Show.
Today is the day the Lord has made for all people. It is a time in which God has decided we shall live. And it is times such as these where it requires us to understand and accept some unique responsibilities. We do have them, right? We've had a really busy show. I hope you heard part three of our discussion with Julie. And maybe you can see now why I feel secure in calling that an attempted psychiatric kidnapping. And, man, sometimes I reflect on the things we talk about on the show. And I'll confess to you still, someone asked me the other day to put meat on the bones of this, explain this a little more, that I worry about the program. The ratings have been stellar. We climbed 21 ratings slots. 21! Since we brought the program back, last time I checked, we're the second most listened to talk show in our demo in Seattle. And first place is an unlimited budget. We're not going to catch them. Other one of it's a great big rock station. We can't do that. It's not what we do. But I worry because I find myself talking about things that I can't fathom. Someone came to me like a year ago and said, "You're going to talk to someone about what appears to be a psychiatric kidnapping." See, oh, come on now. Yeah. Yeah, I hope you heard that. Get the podcast if you didn't. There was a gentleman, we played this in the first hour. We have this thing, you want a little inside radio? The bumper music that we play, which is Dire Straits, we play that. This is to be dramatic, or sometimes just to fill in stuff. We've got so much content in the program. Sometimes we do what's called play over the bump. So we'll play what is called an actuality. See, you're getting a little tiny degree in radio geekisms. We play actualities like this over the bump. This is a gentleman in Minnesota talking to a reporter and or actress from CNN.
I want you to be careful. I want you to be careful. I really
of
do.
What?
Of anything that can
of
hit
what?
You. Of anything that can hit you. Look at
of
all the stuff.
What?
Of this.
Of what?
Of this.
Do it look like I'm scared?
No, you don't.
Do it
you
look
don't.
Like I'm scared?
You don't. You don't.
Exactly. Y'all need to get up out of here with all that twisting up the media.
Okay. Real you don't know me, but we
I don't
gonna
know
get,
you.
We're going to get to know each other. That's
you're
what
gonna
we're going
to get to know
do.
Each other.
Yes,
huh?
We are.
Let's
we
see.
Are. We are.
How you going to know me?
We're going to talk. I'm going to share
yep,
a number with you. All right. Let's do it.
No, let's do it right
let's
here.
Let's do it. All right. Here's my phone. Let's
no,
go ahead and share
camera.
Me a number.
Talk about something that's real.
Tell me what's
y'all
real.
Y'all just going to edit out shit.
We're
don't
live. We're live.
And then y'all going to edit out some other shit.
We're live right now.
You're not.
I'm live right now.
I don't care if you live or not.
Okay.
He wants her out of there. He starts to say, before she cuts him off, twisting things. See, folks who live in neighborhoods that have undergone attacks like this, they tend to view things a little differently. There are a whole bunch of incredibly, I refer to it as ethnic liberalism. What does that mean? Why are you liberal? I was born this way. This is how I've always done it. This is my family's way of doing things. Ethnically liberal in the separate country of Seattle is, well, come on, man. This is how it is. This is the following. This is the flow of the river. This is the way the wind blows. I'm a leaf tossed into the wind. Therefore, I'm liberal. I don't give it any thought. It's feelings. I feel good about it. But when a domestic terror group took over six blocks of downtown Seattle, well, Capitol Hill, adjacent to downtown, there were a lot of ethnically liberal people going, wait, you're going to let people with guns block me from going into Cal Anderson Park where I eat lunch? Yeah. Yeah, we are. Funny thing happens when you live in areas where people are allowed to destroy it with impunity. This is from Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, near where this shooting occurred with the police officer who took the life, apparently, of this young man. And I have a whole bunch of thoughts about his background. But I'm waiting. I'm waiting for the character assassination of the officer. which will inevitably come, and the ignoring of this young man's background, which will inevitably come. This is Brooklyn Center. Listen to these people as the folks who are attempting an insurrection, an armed insurrection, to take over a government building, a police center, are doing this across the street from where kids live. Yes, there are children in these apartments. Reminds me of the gentleman in Portland we've played on the show. Black man who confronted the white kids of Antifa in Portland, pulled up in his brand new SUV and popped out and said, "Who lives here? You're telling them to leave. Who are they? Who lives here? What are their names? Where are they from? What are their stories? You're telling them to leave. You're judging them. You don't know who lives here." He did because he's neighbors with them. The people who are orchestrating this response are going to a genuine feeling of rage. Genuine emotional trauma in all too many folks in the black community. Let's not lie to one another. Let's not do that. There's distrust between many cops and many black people. Let's not lie. There's ways to deal with that. Community policing. This is a proactive step. What is it? You give cops a little extra money in paycheck to live in the neighborhoods they patrol. Why? Because they're seen. Because they're seen. You live in the area patrol, you shop in the area you patrol. You shop, you go to movies, your kids go to school. Community policing used to be a way that you helped solve this distrust. You could have people distrustful of cops, but not him. See, it's really easy to hate them. It's really hard to hate Bob or Janine when you get to know them. So the nefariousness of what they've done, they, the groups who are dividing people by race to destroy America, and the groups that are funding that, I don't need to reprove the case, do I? That Black Lives Matter Incorporated and Antifa are funded and logistically supported with lawyers and medical supply chains and actual medics on the streets. And I mean, we all know that, right? We're not going to lie to each other about that, right? It's an attempt to destroy the country from within. That neighborhood policing thing, that really worked for a long time. We had a neighborhood cop at the school in which I worked, which was a gang-impacted school. When I say gang-impacted, I mean gangsters driving through our playground shooting shotguns into the windows. When I say gang-impacted, I mean a kid in high school, or what was he, junior high, ninth grade, coming by with a gun to murder one of my students because he was jumped into one gang and this kid disrespected his gang. So that's what I mean. We had a community police officer everybody knew. Even the kids who hated cops respected Ron. He was at their soccer games. He was at church. They saw him in the grocery store. He told me a story one day. He and some buddies were out playing pickup basketball. Some of the kids from school came by and said, "Wow, you can shoot threes?" It's like, yes, I was a college athlete. I was a Division I NCAA college athlete. I was a shooting guard. And I got hurt, so I'm a cop. So that all worked. But the people who are organizing this and pushing this and taking advantage of these raw emotions, and never try to take someone's feelings from them, please. These feelings of concern and fear, those are very real. Extremely real. And I guarantee you, if we thought our kids were at risk every time they drove out of the house, down the street, at risk of being killed by the government or government employees, we'd be plenty angry. Now, the fact is, that's not the case. Black cops are more likely to shoot at and kill black suspects than white cops. But that's math. And the people who are orchestrating this are too smart to deal in math. So they deal in absurdities. This is a roundabout way to get to an important place, at least I think so. Absurdities. That's what the left and the people who are pushing this stuff are dealing. Like the absurdity that all cops are racist. The system is racist. Now, see what this does? This allows people who become good with their community police officer, like my friend Ron in where I worked in the schools. They get to say, well, it's not Ron's fault. He's part of a racist system. This extends to black cops. We had the wife of a black cop on our program in the Seattle area who has been in their community forever. She's white. He's black. Their kids are mixed race. He's a racist, according now to the school where his kids go. He's a white supremacist. He's a black man, but also a white supremacist, but it's not his fault because he works for a racist system. Brilliant bit of gibberish. And it can reinstall the suspicion and the bad feelings about cops, even cops you know. When I worked at Microsoft, I got this emergency 911 email. We need you to fly to New York. This deal's falling apart. You're the only one who can save it. Can I do this on the phone? No. You've got to be here, please. They were very close to closing like a $5 million deal, which wasn't that big in Microsoft terms, but for our new startup product, it was really big. And so since I was one of the leaders of the product group and I ran the pricing strategy and the business strategy, all that. Okay, fine. You guys use your budget to get me a decent flight where I can sleep and I'll come back. So I try to sleep on the plane. I go to this thing. I go to this meeting. It's this huge buying agency in New York City downtown. And I sit down with the guy and he says, hey, Todd, look, here's the deal. I love what you're doing. I love that you're putting video online. This was, gosh, 15 years ago, or not even that, but 12 years ago. I love that you guys are taking a leadership position in this. I want to back it, but there's no way I can pay you a $35 cost per thousand. I don't pay that for television. I pay like maybe high point, I pay 15. So sitting there in this conference room and I say, I'm looking at the sales team and they're white with fear. I say, okay, well, I'll give you your $15 cost per thousand. And the sales team's like, the vice president of sales sits back in his chair like shocked, like, because I wouldn't let them sell it that low. I wouldn't let the ads run. He sits back like furious with me. I said, but here's the deal, Greg. I'm going to make sure that the ads, your ads are skippable. I'm not going to run them as one ad and then the content. I'm going to run them with a whole bunch of ads. I'm not going to count who sees them. I'm not going to let people click on your ad. There's going to be no banner ad. And I'm going to do what TV does. I'm going to pretend there's 2.8 times as many people watching that as I know there are. Greg says, you're removing all the value. And I said, no, you are. You are. I'm not a sales guy. I'm a product guy. I'm here to see if this has value to you. And you're showing me with your refusal to pay these rates that it has no value to you. He said, but this is just like TV. I said, exactly. And I'm going to price it just like TV because that's what you told me you'll pay for. He smiled and said, okay, fine. $22.50 cost per thousand. Okay, fine. Your $5 million is guaranteed up front. Deal. Deal. Walked out. We agreed. They're removing all the value. They're removing all the value. As they invent this bizarro world of absurdities, they're removing the value in human beings. Well, you're black. Therefore, you're a victim. Well, wait, what about I'm an NCAA shooting guard who's now a cop, and I'm a veteran and a father and a church deacon. And on the weekends, I volunteer. And by the way, in my basement, I'm ashamed to admit it, but I'm learning to oil paint. And I'm even more ashamed to admit it, but I've grown to love my wife's little tiny dog she had us adopt. But they would take my friend Ron, the cop, and say, no, he's a cog in a racist system, and you are a black person. They're taking all the value, all the uniqueness, all the ability to overcome or to redeem or to forgive. In the case of the young man who was shot, apparently by this cop, they're going to deify him. Now, I'll be the first one to say a young person dying at a young age is an utter tragedy. I don't think there's a lot of value in what I've seen of his posts. I think they're misogynistic. I think they're hatred-filled. And I'm going to hold on the details because I'm anticipating a character assassination of the cop. And I don't believe Duante Wright was his tweets. But the mockingbirds will remove all the value in the story. What led to that point with Duante Wright? Why would a cop be afraid of Duante Wright? Is it really race? What about the cop and the desire to go home at night? Those are the value points of this story. But the race pimps and the social justice scammers and grifters, they can't have real value. They need to sell on the cheap. And that's what they're doing. So for us, we know it. We won't let it work. We'll come back with your text messages on the Todd Herman Show at 800-465-8770 and emails at therman@ktth.com.
It's your turn to text the Todd Herman Show.
The rule's pretty simple.
Be concise, be precise, and drop the mic. 800-465-8770.
And do give yourself a nickname the first time you write it in the text line, then we'll enter into the system. That way you'll never need to do that again. You'll need to do it one time. You can also email me, therman@ktth.com. It's therman@ktth.com. This is a tough email. This is a tough one to hear. It's from Trucker Charlie from Kansas. And Trucker Charlie's been with us quite a little while on the Todd Herman Show. And I've always appreciated you, Charlie, and appreciate the hard work you do as a trucker. People learned that lesson, didn't they? During the beginning of the medically useless, deadly selective lockdown of school children, churches, and small businesses, people learned to appreciate you guys, didn't they? All right, I hope they'll appreciate that some more. Dear Todd, I know what I'm about to ask may be controversial to you, but I'd like your take on this anyway. You often share your faith and your need for redemption on the show, which is, I think, is great. And I think you encourage others to do so and to allow God to continue to reach people through you. But in this vein, I also ask this question concerning gun control. You see, on paper, I'm considered a felon. I prefer not to get into the details of the issue on the air because it's personal and complicated. It concerns a failed marriage in my life. But regardless, I did a little bit of time in a correctional facility. I hear you stand up for the Second Amendment for, quote, law-abiding citizens. But what about those of us who made a mistake or were accused of something and we're not able to adequately fight the issue because of some circumstances, or we end up with a felony on our record. According to the Second Amendment, it says I have the right to keep and bear arms, and this right shall not be infringed. It gives no further criteria. You see, in my situation, there was no weapon at all in what I was accused of and ultimately spent a little time in corrections for, and then being given the badge of felon or criminal, but my rights are infringed. And they're infringed on every day because I am at this time unable to own a firearm. But I want to be able to protect myself and my family as well, especially in these crazy times. To me, yes, I am a gun rights believer. And yes, like you, I believe in redemption. But I also believe it happens now in the Christian faith and not just later when we leave this earth. If this is a God-given right, as I hear you pronounce regularly, then putting on a criteria on it that is not specified in the Second Amendment is wrong. Especially if one of its sole purposes is to protect myself from tyranny, not only by others, but also a runaway renegade government. Why do we keep putting people in boxes and saying they're not eligible for something God says they should have? This is really hard for me because laws do not stop the lawless. They only stop those who are willing to live by the law. I'm doing my best to live by the law, but I'm also becoming increasingly frightened by what I see going on around me. But if I tried to do what it would take for me to be able to do what I believe is right for an American law-abiding citizen to protect myself, I'm then breaking the law and most certainly be punished to a great extent. Living in difficult times and looking for answers on some things that I once thought were no reason to question. I would rather face a person being lawless with something equal or greater than what they have and win the fight than to face them with something less or even worse, nothing at all. I'd really like for you to share this on the air, as I do not feel I'm alone on this in this world in which we live. Thanks and regards, Trucker Charlie from Kansas. Well, Trucker Charlie, you make a tough case for me here because I don't know what you did, and I respect your decision to not share what you did. In fact, if I'm reading your note correctly, I'm not certain that you feel you did it, and maybe you didn't. So you're putting some restraints on this. But I would say that we always need to build redemption into life. Okay, there are some people, and I don't include you in this, Charlie. There are some people who have proven themselves so insanely and repetitively dangerous that we shouldn't even have corrections officials around them. And I hate the death penalty because it gives the government so much power. I loathe it. And for people who've proven themselves unrestrainably dangerous, I will live with my discomfort with the death penalty. There's just a guy who died in prison. I'll not say his name on the air, but he grew to infamy in Idaho when he broke into a home. He murdered, I think it was five people. And then he took two people, little kids, captive. He tortured the boy in front of the girl. And I don't think that this girl needs her name. Well, actually, she signed a letter recently about this man's death. Shasta Groening signed a very brave letter. This guy died in prison of health complications before he could be taken into the death penalty. In that case, I'll live with my discomfort because of what he did and laughed about and bragged about. And he had done these things like this before to children. I don't believe you did anything like that, Charlie. In fact, I know you didn't. You wouldn't be writing in if you had. In a case like that, redemption can only come from God. And in fact, God will judge us for the decision to put a man like that to death. I believe sometimes people are so dangerous, we must allow God to deal with them. In your case, in the case of other people who are convicted of felonies, I do think people should have the opportunity to earn their rights back. I agree. The Second Amendment does not say unless you commit a crime. Doesn't say that at all. So I get your point about it being absolute. And what we've built into our system is when people have broken the rules of society and they've continually broken the rules of society, and I don't hear that you said you're a continual lawbreaker, Charlie. I believe that you're not. when people have proven that they're willing to break the rules of society to, in other words, go and destroy other people's rights, we've decided as a society that we will retract some rights from them. A murderer permanently takes away someone's pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. Someone who assaults someone in a serious way does the same. Someone who robs and takes money from people is taking their life energy. They're violating rights. They're not just breaking the law. They're violating rights. So what we've said is, hey, you've showed yourself to have a habit of violating other people's rights. So we take some rights from them, such as the confinement. The logic that they use behind keeping people with felony records away from guns is it's an extension of confinement. You're being given freedom back, freedom of movement back, freedom to pursue life, liberty, and happiness back, but you're not yet out of confinement. We're virtually confining you. Now that's, Charlie, where maybe you and I agree. There's no such thing as one size fits all. There's one size fits none. We must always offer a path back to full engagement in life for people who leave prison, unless they are proven to be serial abusers, particularly of children or the helpless. In that case, they're so dangerous, they must never have that because they show themselves to have a proclivity for reoffense. So my response to your email is that I think you should have a published, certain method by which you can reinstate your Second Amendment rights. In other words, to fully end your incarceration time. Because the logic is not putting you around guns or letting you have them is an extension of your incarceration time. Now, the part of me that's an amateur lawyer, Charlie, the part of me that beats HOV lane tickets and red camera light tickets and speeding by camera tickets and parking tickets, the amateur lawyer, and I'm not a lawyer, would say, your wife's not a felon. I guess she can own weapons. Maybe she needs to learn to shoot really well. And I guess if you don't own weapons, well, I mean, who's to say you might accidentally avail yourself of one? But that's me playing amateur lawyer. Doesn't make it right to joke about your circumstance, Charlie. I hope there's a path forward for you. I hope that Kansas does have some established ways that you can show you're not a lawbreaker. You're not a career criminal. You don't harm people. Dude, you keep our country moving. That's what Trucker Charlie does. Always appreciate you listening to the show, Trucker Charlie. Thanks for the note. Thanks for sharing that. We'll come back, wrap up the day with a personal note next on the Todd Herman Show at AM 770.
Down on Main Street.
On a personal note today, do you have someone in your life who is a hoarder? This is one of the most interesting phenomena, you know, I think that exists in humankind. Because it can be this incredibly dangerous thing where houses get filled to the brim and if, God forbid, there's a fire, you know, people can't get out. I think there's all sorts of toxic hoarding and there's hoarding that's, you know, sometimes it's got rotted foods and it's this very strange phenomena that I didn't understand. You know, there's all these TV shows and they're either kind of making the person into, you know, some kind of freak for us all to gape at, or they're coming along and trying to help them and watching people struggle through this. And then you get this, like there's this Netflix show with this lady, I can't remember her name, but she wants you to throw away the books. Like if it's not making you happy, get rid of it. Well, maybe it's not making you happy right now, but maybe you're someone who likes great literature and you like to go back and read your books from time to time. Or maybe you'd rather just have Amazon own them all in the cloud. I never understood hoarding. My dad was a hoarder and it was a very uncomfortable thing. Because my dad reached a point where he wouldn't have us over to the house. You know, that was our father's home. And my half-brother lived there. It was interesting because my half-brother kept his room just pristine. It's just absolutely spotless and well-organized. And I've been to his home, my half-brother's, and it's very much that way. And I'm sure part of that's his wife, and I'm sure that's part of my brother's aesthetic. But not being allowed in your father's home because he's embarrassed of it is a really off-putting thing. And I never took it personally, right? Because I knew it wasn't something that my dad liked, but it was something he needed. And part of it was really sick. It really was. You know, I can remember going to my dad's house with a girlfriend, and he'd known her whole life. And we started dating. We dated for a little while, and we were just stopping by to get the keys to the cabin. We were going to go out and go water skiing with a bunch of friends. And he met us on the deck. I remember she said, "Hey, can I go? You know, can we come in?" He said, "It's kind of a mess in there." And I told her on the way out, he's not going to let us in, right? She had to try. Gave us the keys to the cabin. We met our friends out there and all went water skiing. And it wasn't until my father was headed into the hospital that I really discovered the nature of his hoarding. There were, and look, my dad, I believe my dad's in heaven. I believe he has complete insight into what his life was about. I believe he's with God Almighty. So I used to think he'd be really embarrassed by this, like me talking this way, but my view of things now is sort of my dad would say, you know what, share that others might learn. There were some really awful things in my father's house. There were soup cans that had gotten probably botulism and it ballooned up and were ready to burst. There were frozen foods that had long since rotted in the crawl space below. You know, the laundry machines in the garage. So there was some of that, but that wasn't most of it. That's sort of the stuff that came along late. What was really disturbing is that my father had these stacks of newspaper that were all over the carpet, that there was a room that was so filled with newspaper that my uncles and I said, God forbid there was ever a spark of a flame in this house. It would have completely just burst. It would have been an explosion. Really, it was that bad. And my dad was a dear man, a beautiful man who really, in fact, gave his life's energy to us, his kids, and to kids in general. My dad poured out his life's energy for kids because he was a social worker. He was an intervention specialist in the brief retirement he had before God called him. He had he spent his time with Native Americans on Indian reservations, volunteering as a social worker there and as an intervention specialist and as a counselor and a family therapist. And he poured his life into that. And I think home was a place he stored his body. I really mean that. I mean, he had his Westerns that he watched. He had his deer in the backyard, but that was a different thing. My father's yard was largely orderly. His deer always had a fresh salt lick. He always kept the timber cleared up around the house. But in the house, it's where I think he stored his body. My dad didn't like his body. He was overweight, and it always made him uncomfortable, made him feel sad. And yet he was so loved, so very beloved by people. And I'd never understood the nature of the hoarding. I knew there were the letters on his wall. When he was trying to get back into social work after he'd left for a number of years, he put rejection letters on the wall. Some people would say that's motivation. Well, that's motivating you to keep going. That's to be in the fight. Well, I know big-time wrestlers and big-time football players and big-time athletes who put things on their locker saying that they can't beat this person or they can't win this game or they're not favored in this game. And I know that behavior exists. I've seen that behavior. I had a friend of mine who was a wrestler, and he was also insane, and is, in, by the way, in prison. I shouldn't say friend. He was a friend of a friend. He used to go before wrestling matches and have people punch him in the face until he bled. That was the way he got himself up for things. But that's not what my dad was doing with those rejection letters on his wall. I think my dad was reinforcing, you deserve to live in this kind of squalor. I think that's what he was reinforcing. Well, that was my thought. That's my thought. Until I told my dad one day in the hospital, he was laying in bed. I was there with my best friend, who's more like a brother to me, Matthew. My dad adored Matthew. Matthew adored my father. We were in the hospital in Spokane. And I was talking to dad. I said, hey, we're going to go out to your house and clean up some of the junk. And my father looked at me. And his turquoise eyes and his gray beard and gray hair. And he said, junk? There's no junk in my house. Now, part of it was that my dad couldn't see it. It had been there so long. I told him we'd take great care. We went out and we were going through his home and we were starting to clean things, which was carting things out. We took 3 tons of things out of my father's house. But I was in his bedroom and just picking up these old newspapers, and one of them dropped on the bed. And there was a picture of me. It was just a picture of me in a wrestling match. I don't even know that it was that memorable of a match. But it was memorable to him. And so I put that aside. Then I started to go some other things. And wait, there's a tiny little squirt box thing about my sister in a swimming meet. She only swam for a couple of years. It's right there. Stop. Going through some of his shirts, I found invitations to our birthday parties. My parents were divorced. And I said to all my uncles, stop. Let's be really careful. There's some really important things in here. And my dad somehow couldn't separate the non-important from the important. And I think it's because my dad didn't want to miss one drop of time with us. One drop of memory. See, his father was a hoarder too, not as bad as my father was, but my grandfather saved money. He hid it. You've told me, you hear me tell the tales about him hiding money in soup cans and soldering the top back on and putting sand inside so it felt like there was soup in there. We found stock certificates. We probably found $100,000 hidden in my grandpa's house. He was a Depression era baby. My father was a man who never felt loved until he was dying. Then he learned how loved he was. He was a divorced dad who was always guilty about being a divorced dad, always felt guilty. And so his depression was that.
Pete and his Talbot savings again for longevity medical.
Was every single drop of time he ever spent with us. This is the Todd Herman Show. We air every weekday, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. I'll see you tomorrow. Go be well, be strong, and be kind.